Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
In the face of unprecedented disruption, it's become non-negotiable.
Companies are moving to what they call anti-fragile status.
I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte and produced by BBC Storyworks Commercial Productions. Our third episode is about supply chain resiliency and what it takes for organizations to minimize their risk and improve efficiency. So watch out for episode 3 of Resilient Edge, coming soon wherever you get your podcasts. In the face of unprecedented disruption, it's become non-negotiable.
Companies are moving to what they call anti-fragile status.
I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte and produced by BBC Storyworks Commercial Productions. Our third episode is about supply chain resiliency and what it takes for organizations to minimize their risk and improve efficiency. So watch out for episode 3 of Resilient Edge, coming soon wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the BBC World Service. Hello and welcome to NewsHour, which today is coming live from the studios of our friends and partners at Oregon Public Broadcasting in Portland in America's Pacific Northwest. Of course, we have lots of good stuff from here throughout the programme, but we are going to start a long, long way from Portland in Lebanon. And the extraordinary news that several people have been killed and thousands more injured after handheld pagers, the sort of communication devices used by the militant group Hezbollah, suddenly exploded, leading to some shocking scenes. Well, to get a picture of how the day has unfolded, I've been speaking to Lebanon's health minister, Dr. Firas Abiad.
This all started at 3:30 this afternoon when a large number of patients started presenting to our hospitals with the complaint that their pager or communication device exploded. And this has resulted in what we are now reporting around 2,800 casualties, including 200 casualties that are in critical conditions. And up till now, we are reporting 9 deaths, including an 8-year-old child.
And what sort of injuries do those who were wounded have?
So most of the injuries appear to be to the face, especially to the eyes, and also to the hand with some amputations, whether it's in the hand or finger amputations. And some of them have injuries to their flank.
And can you tell us, are all those who have been injured, are they all members of the militant group Hezbollah, or have civilians been injured too?
Well, we're seeing all kinds of people, to be honest. And as you know, the vast majority of people who are presenting to the emergency rooms are in their civilian clothes. So it's very difficult to discern whether they belong to a certain entity like Hezbollah or others. But we are seeing that there are, including amongst them, people who are old or people who are very young, like the child that, unfortunately died. And there are some of them who are healthcare workers.
Can I just ask you this? I mean, it is 2024 and pagers are old technology, and we're told that Hezbollah uses them because they're more secure. But do other people in Lebanon use pagers?
Well, there are, still in hospitals, some of the hospital's personnel who use pagers. But I really cannot comment more on this simply because this is not a part that, from the health sector, we were very much interested in.
It is, though, a major security breach for your country, isn't it?
I think it's a major escalation at a time when everybody was hoping that things are moving towards kind of a cessation of hostilities or some kind of a ceasefire. This is clearly a move in the wrong direction.
Who do you blame for what's happened?
Well, I think, the obvious culprit has to be the Israelis. But I think that the security people will have more to say on this issue.
If that is true, though, how worried are you about escalation along Lebanon's southern border with Israel, with all the potential casualties that might entail?
Well, indeed. I mean, you know, we in the health sector have been quite worried since day one. And that's why we have been holding these drills in preparation for the health sector in Lebanon, preparing for mass casualties that, unfortunately, we experience today. And Lebanon is, as everybody knows, is passing through multiple crises, including a severe financial crisis. So the ability of the healthcare sector to bear more stresses is quite concerning. And that is why I really hope that a solution towards a de-escalation, a ceasefire, would be the option that hopefully can lead us out of this mess that we're in.
And just finally, Minister, have you ever heard or come across anything like this incident? I mean, it seems extraordinary.
This conflict that we are seeing, there are a lot of new things for everyone. But yeah, no, I haven't seen anything like this.
Are you shocked?
I think for people observing the conflicts, whether in the Middle East, in the Ukraine, there are a lot of boundaries that have been crossed. And to be honest, in the Middle East, it's very difficult to be shocked nowadays.
And that was Lebanon's Health Minister, Dr. Firas Abiad. More on this story coming up later on the programme. Let's bring things round to Portland now. It is the biggest city in the US state of Oregon. In the early 20th century, it had a reputation as a gritty port full of brothels and gambling dens. Well, now it's known as a bastion of tolerance and progressive values, full of coffee shops and craft brewers, something we'll be talking about later in the programme. It was also thrust into the headlines 4 years ago when protests against the murder of George Floyd, an African-American man from Minneapolis, by a white police officer turned violent. Well, more recently, that reputation for tolerance has been tested by an experimental new drugs policy. At the end of 2020, people in Oregon voted for a different approach to dealing with burgeoning drug abuse. Some 58% gave their backing to a law decriminalizing the possession of a small amount of hard drugs, things like fentanyl, heroin, methamphetamine and cocaine. Instead of a conviction, users were given a fine, much like a speeding ticket, which they could get out of if they went into rehab. Well, that experiment's just come to an end. And 2 weeks ago, possession once again became a crime. And that was after a public outcry against the number of people openly taking drugs and the influx of people coming to Portland to do drugs.
Fentanyl's strong, you know, and that was just the new thing. It grasped you and didn't want to let go. And I tried to get off of it once myself. Well, I couldn't.
Bill, who's originally from Alaska, tells me he's been a drug addict most of his life. He's 62, but looks older, with a nervous gaze that occasionally breaks into a wry, crinkled smile. Like when he tells me that he came to Oregon because a friend said it was easy to score drugs, in particular fentanyl, coming up the west coast from Mexico. His friend was right. It was easy, and that sent Bill hurtling into the abyss.
See, the problem with the fentanyl, to me, was I couldn't go maybe 2 hours without, and I'd have to smoke it again, or get deathly sick.
Were you worried about overdosing?
No, I wasn't worried about that. It happened once, but no, it didn't change anything. What you worry about is running out.
We've come to downtown Portland now. We're quite near one of the main highways. We're at an intersection, and I've come to talk to Max Williams, who was heavily involved in the campaign to recriminalise the possession of hard drugs. What was your problem with the moves to decriminalise hard drugs? Where did it go wrong?
I think it opened up a considerable more amount of open-air drug use. The consequences that the provisions had allowed for a $100 ticket to be written by law enforcement, but there was zero enforcement. And as a result, we saw increasing amounts of overdoses, increased retail crime and violent crime, and people becoming increasingly concerned about an almost dystopian feel to Portland's downtown.
When we were walking up here, we saw three people openly doing drugs. This is a problem that's going to take a while to fix, isn't it? It's not going to be an overnight change.
I do think collectively, if you were to ask most people in and around the Portland area, they would say things are trending in the right direction, but it's not going to be an overnight success.
Welcome in. This facility here exists exclusively for individuals that require 24/7, 365 medical monitoring. our staff of about 30.
One of the benefits of the Portland experiment, known as Measure 110, was more funding for the treatment of addiction, paid for in a neat twist out of the taxes on sales of marijuana, which is legal in the state of Oregon. That money helped set up this detox facility in the city, run by a charity called Recovery Works Northwest. Joe Bazzeghi is its director of engagement.
Can I ask you this? I mean, there is have been an argument that decriminalization caused more overdoses in Portland. Your best place to answer whether that's true or not, is it?
No, it's not true. What is true is that the replacement of our heroin supply with illicitly manufactured fentanyl, 50 times as strong, has spiraled our overdose death rates. Measure 110 was passed in November of 2020 and implemented in February of 21. We saw a 70% increase in overdose deaths in Oregon in 2020 before the law was implemented.
What do you make of the fact that it's been recriminalized? What do you think the impact will be? I mean, are you unhappy that that step has been taken place? What do you make of it?
People are less likely to engage with treatment if they first have to admit to a crime in order to enter treatment. So people are afraid because criminality is associated with their health condition.
And supporters of decriminalization insist that the basic idea was sound. Spend less on sending addicts to prison and spend more on rehabilitation. The problem, they say, was both the deluge of fentanyl on the streets and also a failure of implementation. In their encounters with police, too few addicts were directed towards treatment. No one paid the fine. And yet hardly anyone pursued the alternative, a call to the special hotline that was set up to get people into rehab. Add to that the ravages of COVID.
I'm Tara Hurst. I'm the executive director of the Help Justice Recovery Alliance. I think the pandemic was really the biggest culprit. Our state was facing some of the most challenging times in at least our generation. How to get vaccines, lockdown, money out the door for people struggling. And so nothing got implemented when it came to law enforcement. They weren't brought in as partners. They weren't brought in to say, okay, here are all the services that were standing up.
Are the resources there? Were they there? Are they still there now to actually get all the people that you see who clearly need help to get them into to treatment?
No. And we're going to lose resources because now we are putting our resources back into law enforcement, which is not the right solution for people who are struggling with an illness.
Unsurprisingly, perhaps, the police see it differently. Sergeant Aaron Schmautz is head of the Portland Police Association, which represents rank-and-file officers. He believes a lack of cooperation undermined the experiment with decriminalization, born out of a wider distrust of the police.
The bill was set up to be a negative tension point between law enforcement and treatment providers. It was to insert treatment providers in and pull law enforcement out, but it left a huge vacuum. Now, over a couple years, the conversation then pivoted to a health approach around addiction. I agree with that, but the way that the law was written prevented us from engaging in interdiction, both with users, but more importantly, with dealers.
Caught in the middle of all these arguments, people like Bill, who was brought back from the brink by Recovery Works. Others weren't so lucky. Last year in Oregon, nearly 1,400 people died from an opioid overdose, a fivefold increase since 2019.
And how are you feeling now?
Oh, it's way better. To be freed up to where I don't have to find a place to hide and smoke, you know, that's pretty good.
So, is it fair to say that this place saved your life?
Oh, that's way fair. Yeah.
Bill there, now 7 months clean. You're listening to NewsHour, coming to you live from Oregon Public Broadcasting in Portland. Still to come on NewsHour, Portland is famous for its craft beer, but the industry is struggling because of a new competitor in town.
Draft sales of beer are down significantly nationally. The consumer trends really are pointing towards other beverages taking precedence. And then we can't sort of disregard the impact that the cannabis industry has had on the consumer.
Well, they're smoking more and drinking less.
We are seeing that trend, yes.
More on that coming up in about 15 minutes. Let's just recap our main headline from the BBC newsroom this hour. 9 people have died and almost 3,000 have been injured by the simultaneous explosion of communication devices used by Hezbollah fighters in Lebanon. The militant group has blamed Israel and has promised revenge. You're listening to NewsHour with James Menendez. Well, let's pick up the drugs policy story here in Portland with Oregon Public Broadcasting's justice and legal affairs reporter Conrad Wilson, who's with me here in the studio. It's very good to have you with us today. It's early days in the new regime here for drugs policy, but what's your assessment of where things stand since the law changed at the beginning of the month?
Well, since the law changed this month, there's been a definite increase in the numbers of people arrested for drug possession. I followed both treatment providers and police officers as they've been out on patrol and watched as they've enforced this new law and also worked to get people into treatment. That's a big part of what this new state law is trying to accomplish. And, you know, that is harder to measure. Even before this new law went into effect, there's been significant improvements in places, like you went to downtown Portland, that just a few years ago had significantly more public drug use. And, you know, at the same time, I think local politicians, treatment providers, and police all seem to agree that there's still more work that needs to be done to help people with drug addiction.
Conrad, I wanted to ask you about something that that the Police Association spokesman mentioned. He talked about bad feeling between some NGOs and the police. Was that in part because of the protests in Portland just before the new drugs policy kicked in, the George Floyd protests?
So a little context. I mean, Oregon's drug decriminalization law was passed and implemented in 2020 and 2021, which was a time of just great upheaval in Portland and really across the country. You know, as people debated the role of law enforcement, of policing. The protests we saw here weren't connected to the drug decriminalization measure, but there was strong anti-police sentiment at the time. You know, supporters of the drug decriminalization law made the case that the criminal justice system had not solved the addiction crisis, and, you know, America's war on drugs really had harmed communities of color in particular, you know, historically. I think what you're hearing is really a philosophical difference with how some treatment providers and some in law enforcement have viewed how best to tackle fentanyl and other public drug use. I mean, I will say the way those tensions are talked about kind of during public meetings or you know, the city council, state legislature, it's not really always the way how it's playing out in the street. You know, I've watched treatment providers work closely and very professionally with police. And, you know, that's been true both before drug possession was recriminalized and after. And I will just say, too, you know, now that law enforcement is once again policing drug possession, they describe feeling a lot of pressure to curb public drug use and help connect people to treatment.
Yeah, and on that point about public pressure, did the politicians here feel they had to act because of that pressure and, of course, because of elections coming up in less than 2 months?
In a word, yes. I mean, you know, Oregon is very much a state dominated by the Democratic Party. And the drug decriminalization law, after several years, had grown increasingly unpopular. State lawmakers very much felt pressure to act. And in recriminalizing drugs here, you know, they're certainly attempting to mute some of the sharpest criticisms from Republicans who've argued Democrats are soft on crime.
Conrad, thank you very much indeed. Conrad Wilson there, Oregon Public Broadcasting's justice and legal affairs reporter. Now, the man at the centre of a high-profile mass rape trial in France has testified in court for the first time. Dominique Pellicot, who's 71, admitted he was a rapist and asked for forgiveness. He's accused of repeatedly drugging his then-wife Gisèle without her knowledge and systematically raping her over many years. What makes this story all the more disturbing is that he's accused of arranging for dozens of other men to also rape her while she was unconscious. 50 men are all accused and will face their own trials. Our correspondent Andrew Harding has been following the trial and sent us this report.
A convoy of police vans bringing some of the 51 accused to court here in Avignon. The men emerge in handcuffs and are escorted in through a back entrance. Meanwhile, at the front of the Palais de Justice, the victim in this case is arriving. Gisèle Pellicot has waived her right to privacy, insisting the shame belongs not to her, but to her attackers. She's a slight, straight-backed, quietly formidable presence. Around her, in the scrum outside the courtroom itself, are men in masks. These are also her alleged rapists, those not in detention. Most of the accused have denied rape. Pellicot sails past them. No cameras or recordings are allowed inside the courtroom. But today, Pellicot's former husband, Dominique, is finally taking the stand, seated just yards from his ex-wife and their family. A translator speaks his words here.
I regret what I did, even if it is unforgivable. I had nothing but love for my wife. We had a perfect family. It was me who was not good.
Pellicot says he was not born evil, that he himself was abused as a child. But he says this in the manner of someone seeking to explain, not to excuse his actions. And significantly, he is quick to condemn his co-accused.
I am a rapist, like the others in this room. They knew everything.
Gisèle Pellicot sits through all this. Then she's asked to respond in court. Her words here also spoken by a translator.
It is difficult for me to listen to this. I lived with this man for 50 years. I could never have imagined him capable of this. I trusted him completely.
That apparently happy, trusting couple lived until 2021 here in the nearby medieval village of Mazan. The sense of shock in this small community is deepening by the day. The French police now say they have evidence that 80 local men took part in the rapes. 50 of them are now on trial. 30 more have yet to be tracked down. Amongst those men were young, old, rich and poor from all walks of life. And strikingly, not a single one of them thought to contact the police after seeing what was happening at that house. I've just run into Isabel and her daughter Océane, two local women.
We know 30 of them still haven't been caught. There are tensions here because we don't know if we can trust our neighbours anymore.
But others here, mostly men, seem keen to play down their village's role in this extraordinary case. And a few go much further, suggesting Gisèle Pellicot, the victim, got off relatively lightly. This is Mazan's mayor, Louis Bonnet.
It could have been far more serious. There were no kids involved. No women were killed. The family will have a hard time, but they can rebuild. After all, nobody died.
No wonder, perhaps, that so many French women have taken to the streets in recent days to protest against what they see as a society and a justice system that failed to take rape seriously enough, and to praise one remarkable woman, Gisèle Pellicot.
She chose to speak in front of her rapists, in front of all the world, and it's so brave. It's a huge gift she made us.
Inspiring.
Yes, she's really an inspiring woman, absolutely.
And this afternoon, applause from women inside the courthouse as Gisèle Pellicot walks past. For once, and only briefly, her familiar, solemn expression breaks into a smile.
That was Andrew Harding reporting from France. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're broadcasting today from the studios of Oregon Public Broadcasting in Portland. Do stay with us. More from America's West Coast coming up in the next half hour, and more on Lebanon too. A good point just to let you know that there is a live page on what is happening in Lebanon up and running at the moment on our website. It's bbc.com/news. Do stay with us though. As I say, much more to come in the next half hour.
It used to be seen as a costly and risky challenge, but sustainability has now become a business imperative.
Not having the data is no longer an excuse.
I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte and produced by BBC Storyworks Commercial Productions. Our second episode is all about moving from intention to action on sustainability. Episode 2 of Resilient Edge is coming soon, everywhere you listen to podcasts. It used to be seen as a costly and risky challenge, but sustainability has now become a business imperative.
Not having the data is no longer an excuse.
I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte and produced by BBC Storyworks Commercial Productions. Our second episode is all about moving from intention to action on sustainability. Episode 2 of Resilient Edge is coming soon, everywhere you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. Malaysia's enjoyed extraordinary economic success over the past 30 years. It's on the brink of high income status as a nation. But now its population is aging fast, and despite its development, growing numbers of elderly people are at risk of poverty because they don't have pensions or anywhere near enough savings to live on into old age. Claire Balderson reports from Kuala Lumpur.
It's Saturday evening in central Kuala Lumpur, and at the Kachara Soup Kitchen, volunteers are preparing food parcels for distribution on the streets of the Malaysian capital. There are plastic boxes filled with noodles or rice and crates of fresh fruit and bread rolls.
The majority of the people receiving food from our soup kitchen, 60% of them are actually over the age of 60.
Justin Chia is one of the charity's most senior and long-serving members of staff.
They are literally stranded, living every day, just looking for their next meal, paying for their next day of rent. Yeah.
At the soup kitchen's outreach station on a street corner, I meet Mr. Lim, who's 68 but looks much older.
He is 68 and he has a problem with his health. He has knees problem and unable to find a job, so he has to be here to get food.
Mr. Lim was a construction worker in the private sector. There are no state pensions for people like him. Instead, private sector workers, the majority of the labour force, have something called the Employees Provident Fund, or EPF, which is more like a retirement savings account.
By the age of 55, you can withdraw the entire pension fund, and that is just very minimal for a wage worker. So he said he already spent it.
So he already spent the pension?
Yes.
It's all gone?
Yes.
It's not uncommon in Malaysia for employees to quickly use up their EPF funds. People are living longer, but they're not saving more. And according to the EPF, only about 18% of account holders have anywhere near enough for a secure retirement. So why is it so hard to put money aside? Professor Norma Mansour is director of the Social Wellbeing Research Centre at the University of Malaya.
In the past 30, 40 years, wages were low, so savings were very low. So the current generation of 60s and older, quite a big percentage of them do not have the kind of savings that you would require to support you during old age.
You know, Malaysia's had fantastic development, and yet the social safety net doesn't seem to have kept up. Is there an imbalance between those two things?
I think the approach, Claire, in Malaysia is always that it was about employment. Employment is seen as a safety net, and also you can rely on your family members in case of crisis.
Relying on family for support worked while Malaysia was a youthful country with fewer old people and 5 or 6 children per family. But in a modern urbanised economy, there are clear signs that the traditional safety net is under strain.
Claire Balderson reporting there from Malaysia. This is James Menendez. You're listening to NewsHour, which today is coming to you live from the studios of Oregon Public Broadcasting in Portland in America's Pacific Northwest. Now, all the polling suggests that the economy is the number one issue for voters going into November's elections here in the US, and in particular, the issue of inflation. Like many countries, prices have been going up sharply for several years, leaving many households and businesses struggling to stay afloat.
Latest figures suggest the rate of inflation is starting to come down, but things are still tough. Take Oregon's famous craft brewing industry. There are about 400 breweries in the state, employing an estimated 50,000 people. But rising costs and changing habits forced at least 30 to close last year, with others likely to follow. Well, we've been finding out about the state of the industry at a pub that brews its own beer. Yes, I know, it is a tough gig. But first, though, to a farm about an hour outside Portland, where the hops used to flavour many craft beers have been harvested.
I'm Todd Cook, and I'm a hop grower here in the Willamette Valley in St. Paul, Oregon, in the United States.
So tell us what we're looking at here.
We're in the last few days of our hop harvest, and all the vines from the field get brought into our picking facility, and then the hops all get stripped off of the vines themselves and the leaves also, and then those have to go through a whole process of getting separated.
And the smell is fantastic, that sort of perfume smell, isn't it? I mean, you're probably used to it now.
All you great craft beer lovers, you would love to be able to smell these hops when they come in through the kiln floor.
It's that same aroma, isn't it? How is business at the moment for hop growers in Oregon?
Last year we were down like 12%, and this year we're down another 18%, so it's pretty drastic. There's a lot of fields sitting around that are idle. There's a lot of farmers in our local area that they're making that ultimate decision to switch over to a different crop.
And what do you put that down to?
I think mostly it's consumer preferences on their beverages.
I mean, craft beer has a reputation for being a little more expensive. I mean, it obviously costs more to produce. Is it also because drinkers are cutting back on their financial consumption, if you like? They want to spend less on their drinks?
We have some brewers come out from our local breweries in Portland area, and they come get fresh hops. And one of them was talking about they usually put like 7 or 8, maybe even 10 pounds of hops in a barrel, and they've cut it back. If they can make a six-pack for $14 instead of a six-pack for $20, it can sell more. But they're not using as many hops, so it comes down and hurts all the way back down to our little homegrown farms.
We hear a lot about inflation. I mean, it's obviously a big topic going into the election in November. How has that impacted your production cost?
All of our inputs have gone up. We need more people to drink more beer.
That doesn't sound too bad.
Well, yeah, it should be pretty easy. Everybody just go spend your dollars.
We are going into this election in November. I mean, do you have any idea, you know, which presidential candidate might be better for your business and better for the economy more widely? Is that something that you're thinking about now as we're
less than a couple of months away?
I don't think I'm going to go endorse somebody right now. I have somebody in mind, but
give us a clue.
I know things were rolling a few years ago pretty good, the economy and such, and they're not so much at this time. So we're hoping whatever happens, it turns around.
That sounds to me like you want Donald Trump back in the White House, that you think the economy was better when he was in charge.
Well, I think with what I said there, that a few years ago we were rolling a little more in the economy, I think that probably answers the question.
Well, it's just a short drive from the hop fields back into the city, and one of Portland's many craft breweries. We're here at Lycum Brewery with Sonia Marie, who owns it. How's business for you?
We are in recovery from the pandemic. We're definitely seeing some shifts in how the consumer is treating beer, and we're on unstable ground, but moving forward.
We've been hearing that the demand from brewers for the hops is decreasing. In other words, you guys aren't needing so many hops. Why is that happening? Is that just because demand for craft beer is down?
Draft sales of beer are down significantly nationally. The consumer trends really are pointing towards other beverages taking precedence. And then we can't sort of disregard the impact that the cannabis industry has had on the consumer.
Well, they're smoking more and drinking less.
We are seeing that trend, yes.
And what about the economy more widely? Are people also just going out a bit less because people are feeling the pinch? They're having to tighten their belts a bit.
Yeah, I definitely think that's a factor. And I think what we've really observed is it's no longer coming to meet up with a friend and just sort of an after work drink on your way home. It's, oh, I'm going to Lycum for a comedy show or bingo.
Can you live off the money that you make from the brewery and the bar?
The answer is no. My husband Theo is employed by the brewery, although at a very reduced salary. And I spend part of my time working in the nonprofit sector to make ends meet.
And we hear a lot about inflation. Has that been hard to contend with? Presumably rising costs of energy, ingredients and so on. Has that been tough?
Very tough. Our electrical utilities have been up, what, 17% since the beginning of the year. It feels oftentimes like we will never be able to grow enough to make ends meet.
Is anything going to change after the election and who might be able to turn things around in the wider economy, if you like?
Yeah, I think that there is a recognition that the economy is a priority and that there needs to be a shift.
I mean, Donald Trump says he's the man to do that. Do you think he is?
I do not. He's not the best ally for my personal small business and the industry as a whole. I'll leave it at that.
Keep your vote secret.
Oh, my vote is not secret. Absolutely not. For all of its flaws that it may have, I absolutely will be voting for Kamala Harris and the Democratic Party.
And that was craft brewer Sonia Marie Lycum. Well, as we heard, she and Todd, the hops farmer, disagree about which presidential candidate is best placed to help their businesses. So what are the economic visions of Kamala Harris for the Democrats and Donald Trump for the Republicans? I've been talking to Betsy Stevenson, professor of economics at the University of Michigan and a former member of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisers, and also Steve Moore, one of Donald Trump's economic advisers and also a visiting fellow at the conservative think tank the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. I began by asking Steve how he thought Donald Trump would help small businesses like Sonia Marie's microbrewery.
Well, I think that if you look at what happened with the American economy when Trump was president, especially before COVID hit, you know, the U.S. economy was as strong as it's ever been. And the policies of reducing taxes and promoting American energy policy and policies like reducing the regulations on the American economy were hugely important in terms of creating the prosperity that we had. You know, the average family in America gained about $6,000 in real income, which was an all-time record, whereas the average family has lost income by about $2,000 since Biden came into place. So we want
but
this
what,
to
what
be...
But what would he do economy. Now, though, to improve the economy and get inflation down?
Put the policies back in place, make sure that the tax policies remain low, produce as much American energy as we can, our oil, our gas, our coal, our nuclear power, everything we have, get government off the back of our businesses so that they can prosper. Those kind of policies were quite successful when Trump was president. And, you know, as you heard from some of your the people you interviewed, the working class Americans are feeling incredibly strained financially after 3.5 years of Biden and
Let me bring in Betsy Stevenson. Kamala Harris says she's a champion of the middle and working classes. What would she do for people like Sonia Marie and Todd Cook?
Well, you know, I want to start by saying let's not put aside COVID, because we can't put aside COVID. We had a massive recession that was due to an unprecedented pandemic. And as we came out of that recession, we had a lot of adjustments. One of the things both President Trump and President Biden did was put a lot of money in people's hands because they wanted to make sure that there wasn't suffering. They wanted to make sure people didn't lose their homes, that they could make it through the pandemic. The problem is that left a lot of households chasing goods and services, and businesses had shut down because of the pandemic. So we had a gap where we had people wanting to buy a lot of stuff, but there wasn't a lot of stuff available.
So what I'm sorry to press you, what happens now, just because we're slightly limited for time, what happens now?
So what happens now is we need to continue the unprecedented increase in new business formation that has happened under the Biden administration. And to make sure that we help families really in their pocketbook, one of the things Kamala Harris is calling for is increasing housing supply. That's the best way to bring down the cost of housing. If you look at inflation numbers, that's where families are still really hurting. And what they need to see is the proposals that, you know, Kamala Harris is calling for the construction of 3 million new housing units. What that will do is bring down housing prices to make things more affordable for our families.
Steve Moore, Donald Trump's talked about a 10% increase in tariffs on U.S. imports. That's going to push up prices considerably, isn't it?
Well, I'm not a big fan of his tariff policies, although Trump used, let's not forget that tariffs have been higher under Biden than under Trump. It's a kind of an amazing fact, but true. So Biden has been much more the candidate of tariffs than even Trump was. And so that's one thing. But look, even on all these programs that Kamala Harris is talking about, all these giveaway programs like healthcare is going to be free and housing is going to be free and childcare is going to be free. I mean, my God, we've had the most financially irresponsible president in the history of the United States. And Joe Biden and Kamala Harris wants to pour even more spending and more free things at a time when our country is going to go bankrupt. I think Americans are sort of on to that, you know, as Ronald Reagan used to say, a government that's big enough to give you everything you want is big enough to take everything you have. And so I think this is a good discussion because you couldn't really pick two presidential candidates who are more far apart on the economy than Trump and Kamala Harris. I mean, Trump wants to cut taxes. Kamala Harris wants a $5 trillion tax increase.
Yeah, let me get a response to all that you've been saying. Betsy Stevenson?
So there's no proposal that housing is going to be free, that all these things are going to be free. You know, what Kamala Harris is proposing is that it's going to be easier to get into a starter home, that she's going to fund the building. She's going to provide subsidies for building starter homes. She's going to provide subsidies for low-income households to be able to buy that first home. You know, Donald Trump's out there also saying that he's going to fund housing. He's just going to fund it for the rich because he's saying right now what he wants to do is change his own tax policy by putting that SALT deduction back on so that high-income families can get that bigger subsidy on their homes. So, and the taxes, the property taxes they pay on them. So I think what we need to do is look at the details of what's being proposed. It's not all about big government, small government. Both candidates, frankly, seem to want to spend a lot of money. I think what we need to be asking is who do they want to spend money on? And Kamala Harris wants to spend it on children, the next generation, and the kinds of things that everyday families need, like housing.
That was Betsy Stevenson, former economic advisor to President Obama. I was also talking to Steve Moore, one of Donald Trump's economic advisors. You're listening to NewsHour. You're listening to NewsHour. Let's return to our top story today. The Lebanese government says at least 9 people have been killed and thousands more injured by exploding pagers detonated simultaneously. Among the dead, at least 2 fighters from the Hezbollah militant group. The group is known to use pagers rather than cell phones for fear that those are tapped. Hezbollah has blamed Israel for what it calls a criminal aggression. Israel has yet to comment. Well, let's hear from our security correspondent, Gordon Carrera, and with him in the studio in London, my colleague Tim Franks, a former Middle East correspondent, to look at what this means. And I spoke to Gordon first of all. Pagers don't just explode. So what happened in Lebanon?
Well, I think we can have some informed speculation because you're right, they don't just explode. I mean, people were talking about cyber attacks or them overheating. None of that seems right given the imagery and given the way these pagers operate. I think the best guess is that a small amount of explosives was placed inside these pagers, which obviously are kind of one-way communication devices, which can receive effectively a form of text message. And one of those could have been used then to signal and detonate those explosives to go off. So a very, very sophisticated attack, which would have taken months of planning in order to put those pieces in place and get those pagers out to people. But as we heard, it's partly because Hezbollah is thought to have turned to pagers, not widely used these days, because they feared the use of phones and that reliance on them has then been turned against them.
As we heard, Hezbollah is pointing the finger squarely at Israel and indeed members of the Lebanese government. Israel isn't commenting. I mean, is the working assumption that it is the doing of Israel?
I think it would be extraordinarily surprising if it wasn't. But you wouldn't expect the Israelis to comment. They don't comment on these kind of overseas intelligence operations. But they do have a track record of doing similar things. For instance, you go back to 1996 and they actually used a small explosive in a cell phone to take out one person. And they've used explosives in the headrests of cars to target people. But I think what's different about this is the scale of it. We're hearing about thousands being injured. This is very different from the individual targeted killings that Israeli intelligence is thought to have been responsible for in the past. A much more significant operation, but still in line, if you like, with the kinds of ways they operate and the fact that they are engaged effectively in a conflict with Hezbollah at the moment anyway.
Let me bring in Tim. Hello, Tim. What's your assessment of Israel's strategy, if indeed Israel was responsible?
I think there are a number of possibilities here, James. I mean, Gordon was saying Israel is involved in a conflict with Hezbollah, and we shouldn't forget that that conflict has been going on for 11 months, I mean, since pretty much the day of the Gaza war beginning. So this could mean it's a prelude to a wider operation. As Gordon was saying, these were the communication devices that Hezbollah was increasingly relying on, and therefore disrupting that could mean that Israel thinks it's got a good chance now to press on and have a wider operation against Hezbollah, perhaps even an invasion into southern Lebanon. It could have been conceivably to prevent a planned Hezbollah operation. I mean, there are reports in the Israeli media about their intelligence services perhaps picking up, detecting unusual military preparations by Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. Could be something to do with that. It could also be that Israel feared that its breach of Hezbollah's pager system was about to be exposed, and so they just thought, well, you know, now is as good a time as any. I mean, it could be any one of those. It could be a combination. It could be something else entirely. I think at the moment it is, we are speculating, and we're of course speculating about what comes next.
Yeah, I mean, does it leave Hezbollah with little choice but to respond in some fashion?
Well, they will, I'm sure, want to respond in some fashion. But, we have been discussing these potential tipping points really every few months, it feels, over the last 11 months, whether some confrontation between Israel and Hezbollah or Israel and Iran is going to presage a wider regional war. And I think, you know, what we can say with some certainty is that neither Israel nor Hezbollah nor, it seems, Iran particularly want there to be an all-out conflict. But nonetheless, there is pressure from within Israel to do something to change the situation on their northern border. Tens of thousands of Israelis are still displaced because of the fire that Hezbollah has been pouring into northern Israel on pretty much a daily basis. Obviously, Israel is also attacking widely in southern Lebanon and displaced tens of thousands of people there, killed several hundred Hezbollah operatives as well. I think there's a lot of pressure there. I think there's been a lot of speculation in recent days as to whether the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, is going to replace his Defence Minister, Yoav Gallant, who's widely reported as being much more sceptical about the value of a big operation against Hezbollah right now. So who knows where this could go? But I can tell you one thing, and that is that right now in Washington, there will be near panic, because the last thing that the Biden administration wants, I mean, both for the reasons that a regional war is not good for anyone, but especially with the election hoving interview, is a much wider Middle Eastern war.
Gordon, can I just get a final word from you, from an intelligence point of view? Because I was also thinking about the assassination of the Hamas political leader in Tehran by a bomb supposedly planted some months before. Given that and what has happened now, I mean, it suggests a pretty deep penetration of Israel's enemies, doesn't it?
Yes, and that's one of the things that will deeply unsettle them. I mean, beyond the injuries inflicted by this will be the knowledge that Israel was able to get inside Hezbollah's communication systems in an extraordinary way, literally inside them physically, and carry out this attack. And I think the psychological impact is also significant from this, as well as the physical damage, if you like, in terms of showing the reach of Israeli intelligence.
And that was our security correspondent, Gordon Carrera, and NewsHour's own Tim Franks joining me from our studios in London. As I mentioned before, there is a live page up and running on our website with all the latest developments from Lebanon. It's at bbc.com/news. But that is it for this special edition of the programme from the studios of Oregon Public Broadcasting in Portland in the US. Thank you very much to them for hosting us today. And of course, thanks to our teams here in the US and in London. Until the next time, do take care. Bye-bye.
It used to be seen as a costly and risky challenge, but sustainability has now become a business imperative.
Not having the data is no longer an excuse.
I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte and produced by BBC Storyworks Commercial Productions. Our second episode is all about moving from intention to action on sustainability. Episode 2 of Resilient Edge is coming soon, everywhere you listen to podcasts. In the face of unprecedented disruption, it's become non-negotiable.
Companies are moving to what they call anti-fragile status.
I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte and produced by BBC Storyworks Commercial Productions. Our third episode is about supply chain resiliency and what it takes for organizations to minimize their risk and improve efficiency. So watch out for episode 3 of Resilient Edge, coming soon wherever you get your podcasts.